I work with teenagers, and I mean, it's not very often that you have to preach 2 days after you've been on a roller coaster. I made it. I did realize I've crossed some sort of threshold in my life where it feels fun when I'm on the roller coaster, but then, like, when the cart pulls into the stop, it's like all of a sudden all of my, like, I don't know, my life experience and children and everything catch up to me, and all of a sudden it hits you like a ton of bricks. So I have a feeling I'm going to be the bag watcher more and more often as I get older, which is challenging because we have a daredevil for a first child. So it's going to be it'll be interesting to see how we have to switch off handling that. But it's true, it is convenient. I did not plan it this way, but it's convenient that 2 days after riding massive roller coasters that hurtle you down a steep cliff at like 75 miles an hour, that we're talking about fear. We're talking about what does it mean to live in the world that we live in and not succumb to the ever-present, ever-growing feeling that things are falling apart. I think it's easy and justifiable to feel afraid in the world that we live in today. Between religious extremism, kind of yo-yoing economics, the unabated technological progress we experience, terrorism, war, poverty continuing to rage across our planet, it's pretty obvious that we should have some things to be afraid about. I mean, it seems like it's almost not possible to even live in the middle ground between anything anymore. Do you feel me? That it feels like you're either one thing or you're another thing. You're either conservative or liberal. You're either, you know, everything is black and white. You know, you're either part of the 99% or the 1%. You're either an entitled millennial or you're an out-of-touch boomer. There's no, like, in-between there, apparently. I think it's justifiable, I think, with especially all of the questioning and understandable assumptions that we've questioned about the way the world works and about institutions and traditions, those things that I think do need to be questioned from time to time, that we have this counterbalancing impulse of kind of wondering, where do we stand? How do we find a place of firmness and stability in the midst of all of that? I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but when somebody is running for a particular office, let's say, his name rhymes with, I don't know, Gump, it's hard to not feel like, what is happening in the world that we live in? I mean, I think even with just Twitter and Facebook and internet news and cable TV and CNN and, you know, even the good old-fashioned newspaper carrying more information than most people would have experienced in their lifetimes, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and feel consumed by all of it. And I think it's easy for us to start to question, how do we even find grounding in that? Because here's the thing, we're wired as people to make sense of the world around us. We're kind of interpretive animals. That's the way we work. We look at the information that we gather with our senses and we try and categorize it. We try to make sense of it. And so when things stop making sense to us, we get afraid. We start to question and wonder if the categories we had really even work anymore. And so I think it's normal then in that situation then for a lot of us when we don't have those categories, when we don't really know what to do with everything, to kind of hunker down and kind of batten the hatches and wait for the storm to blow over. We kind of assume that really the problem is that the world has just kind of gotten out of whack and we got to wait for it to fix itself again. And so a lot of us, you know, we're in the middle of all of this storm, just trying to make sense of it, and all we can do is shut down. And I think it makes sense that in the middle of all of that, that we have the conflict that we feel between the desire to become better people, to better ourselves, to raise our kids in the right environment, to want to do well at our jobs, to want to make good connections with our family and friends and our neighbors, that in the midst of all of that, we feel this kind of ever-present anxiety about what to do with it all. And I think that that adaption, that desire to adapt to our environment and kind of just make sense of all of it, kind of comes with a cost. And that cost is that we have this hyper mentality in our culture to distraction. That we desire so deeply to feel at peace and to feel stable that we will do anything to cover over that feeling of fear that keeps creeping into our lives when we just don't know. And so we, you know, binge on Netflix and distract ourselves with our phones and just try and not get too caught up in it all. In fact, biologically, we know that one of the reactions our bodies have to fear is to actually shut down our prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brain that is rational and makes decisions. So when we get scared, when we get overwhelmed, our bodies literally make it impossible for us to rationalize things. So we just go back to whatever our defaults are. We go back to whatever it is that we already feel like we know. And so we have this problem then of how do we live in that world and yet try and be the kind of people that we know we were destined to be? Do we try to become the good people that God created us for? And so here's the thing. It's easy, I think, to just... It's easy, I think, to just write it off, to just say, this is the way the world works. We just have to endure it. This is kind of a waiting room for the afterlife, and we just kind of stick it out. And, you know, what do you do when you're in a waiting room, right? Does anybody here, like, have deep, profound insights about life when they're in a waiting room? No, you're reading, like, an 8-year-old magazine or playing Candy Crush on your phone, or you're doing something to just make it go faster, right? It was amazing when I was at Wonderland. It was amazing the mental shift of the people in the lines versus the people walking around the park. Because the people walking around the park were talking and hanging out and talking about what rides they were going to go on and all this kind of stuff. But then as soon as they had to wait for something, as soon as they had to stop and wait for a ride, everybody pulled their phone out. They're like, oh, I better check Twitter like for this like 20 minutes I'm in this line just in case something interesting happened in the last like 20 minutes, right? Like it's like all of a sudden that feeling of having to wait is unbearable. And so we just numb through it, right? We just try to get through it as fast as possible. We distract ourselves and we try to get through it. The problem with that mentality and the problem with thinking that way is that it robs us of what this life is all about. It robs us of believing in the ability for the human life to have meaning. We just think of it as this kind of testing ground or this kind of demo chamber or this waiting space for the real life. Or we do the opposite, right? Which is we say, and I think for many of us, we were maybe raised to believe this, that this life, this experience that we have is all there is. That all that really matters is the day-to-day reality of this planet. And so we get this frustration of kind of like, which one is it? Am I supposed to just, you know, become a good person so that I can move on to a better life when I die and get into heaven or karma or whatever you want to think it is? Or we just become very cynical and sarcastic and feel like this is all there is. And so I think the thing is we'd rather just keep busy a lot of the time than actually deal with that tension that's brewing underneath us, that's slowly becoming to a boil where all of a sudden we start to wonder if we're missing out on something. And so the message today is going to be about asking you to slow down enough in your life to take a look at why and how you feel. And especially, is there a fear that maybe is either just poking at the back of your head all the time, or is there maybe that sense of weight and helplessness when you get up in the morning? I think all of us are struggling to make sense of how to hold on in a world that feels like it's falling apart. And so the question then becomes, how do we wrestle with fear as a reality in our life and yet not be controlled by it? How do we realize that God gave us this instinct to protect ourselves? That's what fear is. Fear is a protection instinct. We feel fear for a reason. It saves us from bear attacks, okay? Whenever my wife and I go on vacation and we go to a hotel room, I always ask her, do you want to defend us from the bears or the burglars? The burglars come in through the window, the bears come from the front door because they're civilized like that, okay? So this is the thing. We are afraid for a reason. We were designed to feel fear for our protection. The problem is most of the things that we need to be protected from don't really bother us anymore, right? We're not constantly on the run from animals. We're not constantly having to protect our family and friends from attack. We're not. And so all of a sudden when we start to perceive fears that maybe aren't always there or aren't always imminent, we start to inflate them in our minds, and then that causes us to shut down that ability to think. And so what I want us to think about today is, how do we live with that reality? How do we live with the very human reality of fear and yet try to live as the kind of people that God wants us to be and the kind of people that can have full and rich lives? And what's amazing is, because fear is such a core human experience, the Bible talks about it a lot. It's almost as if God knew we were going to have to deal with this. And so today what we're going to do is we're going to look at a passage from the letter called 1 John, John writing to a small church in Asia Minor that we're going to examine a little bit. I'm going to give you a bit of the backstory, kind of explain to you what that has to do with our present situation. And then we're going to pull out some principles from that that I think work on how we are figuring out fear. And then I'm going to tell you a story from my own life about how I've had to manage fear. And I'm convinced that if you embrace the truth that's in this letter today, I think things won't just be better for you and your family and your spouse. I think it'll actually be better for our world, because I think the reality is the situation we find ourselves in the world today is actually because a multitude of individuals have given into fear instead of hope. So are you with me? Are we ready to go? Let's do this. Okay, 1 John chapter 4. Says this: if anyone acknowledges that Jesus is the Son of God, God lives in them and they in God. And so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In the world we are like Jesus. There is no fear in love. But perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. So early in the first century, there were a group of Jewish people that had kind of banded together in these communities throughout the Roman Empire. And one of these groups of people kind of coalesced around the city of Ephesus. That's where we get, there's another letter in the Bible called Ephesians, and it's written to another church that's based in Ephesus. But historians think that the letter of 1 John was actually written to a bunch of smaller communities that were kind of spread throughout the countryside, kind of surrounding Ephesus. And Ephesus was a major center of commerce in the Roman Empire. In fact, at one point, it was the third largest city in the Roman Empire. And so it makes sense that a group of Jewish people would have moved there from Israel to make their way in the world. They would have moved there for business. They would have moved there for trade. They would have moved there to settle down. And when they moved there and settled down, they brought with them this story of this man named Jesus that they were following as the long-awaited Messiah. And so we have a group of Jewish followers of Jesus in the first century living in these small communities, trying to figure out, what does it mean now that we are these Jewish people with this rich historical story of God working in our lives, and now we follow this man Jesus that is the long-awaited Messiah that has been prophesied throughout history for us. And so they have to bring together these two worlds. They have to bring together their Jewish world, and they have to bring together their new world of following Jesus. And in fact, their new world of following Jesus is starting to kind of upend and change and challenge the world that they knew. And so what ends up happening is they have all of these questions. They have all of these concerns. And so as a busy, buzzing metropolis and a city, you know, of the suburbs and the towns that they're surrounded in, that they're living in, people are coming and going through their town all the time. And one of the things that the Jewish communities that John writes to that are struggling with is the fact that people have started kind of coming and going out of their faith community, out of their little churches that they had formed, and challenging their understanding of who Jesus was. And so John writes to them and says this. He says, guys, listen. You're going to have people coming and going out throughout the community. You're going to have people come in and say, hey, I was in such and such town, and they said this about Jesus, and that's actually what's true. And the thing you heard from John and the other disciples, that's not really true. And so John writes to them to kind of combat this infiltration in their community. He's writing to them to say, this is the reality of your truth. This is really what's going on. And this is what you need to drive deep within you so that you can function in this topsy-turvy world that you find yourself in. And we're not really sure what caused John to write to them. There was, like, we don't have a historical record of some incident that exploded, and that's why John had to write them a letter. But Roman rule wasn't seen to the Jewish people as just this kind of, you know, fact, this historical fact. We think of it like, oh, there's the Greek period and the Roman period and the Byzantine period and whatever, right? They weren't just like living through historical record. They were oppressed political refugees. These are people that felt like the land that God had given them had been taken away. And they wanted to know when Jesus, this Messiah, this political rescuer, was going to fix things. And so when people came along and said, well, you know, Jesus wasn't really a man. He's more of an idea, and an idea that should unite you in battle. They'd go, oh, that sounds kind of great, right? That'll solve our problems. We won't be oppressed anymore. We won't have to hide in these little huddles out in the country. We can move back into the city and back into power. And so it's clear from the contents of this letter, if you look at the whole letter, and it's honestly, the book of 1 John is great because you can read the whole thing in like 20 minutes. It's like 12 pages. It's clear from the letter's contents and the context of it that these Jewish followers were wrestling with this reality of how do they warp their way of seeing the world around his reality. And so you may be wondering, well, what does this have to do with fear? Because we don't live in an unstable political climate where people feel like they're looking for answers and they want somebody to ride in as a politician and tell them how to fix everything, right? We're not waiting in our day for things to go back to the way we wish they were. We're not waiting for all of the answers in the world to get better, right? See, fear is timeless. Fear is a human reality. And John's goal isn't just to warn them about these false teachers that might be infiltrating their community. John's focus is to reground them in the reality of who Jesus is and how the reality of who Jesus is causes them to start to reorient the entire way they see the world. So rather than giving into hate, doubt, and aggression, they're called to be who their leader is, a man who loved people. And so we tend to think in our world that security is going to come from three things. We think it's going to come from possessions, we think it's going to come from prestige, and we think it's going to come from power. We think that security comes from us having a lot of stuff, having a lot of power, and having a lot of influence. Right? And so we often try, and in order to fix the things we think are wrong with the world, we try and get those three things. Right? We try to make a lot of money, we try to get a lot of influence, and we try to stop things that we don't like to happen. That's what power is, right? It's the ability to make things happen that you want to have happen. And that's why it's so easy to be afraid when you don't have those three things, right? That's why it's so easy to give in to fear when you feel like you don't have a lot of power, you don't have a lot of influence, and you don't have a lot of money. In fact, this is one of the major reasons why teenagers often seem so kind of angsty and depressed. It's because they look at themselves and they think, I see all of these things that I don't like about the world around me, and I can't do anything about it. Because I've got no money, I've got no power, I've got no influence. Right? And so, it's into this reality that John injects a shocking wave of Jesus' attitude. He tells them, you need to completely change your entire paradigm about how to do this. And so this is what John says to them. He says, you aren't just flesh and bone. You are a spiritual being. And the leader of your spiritual being isn't somebody that leads through power, prestige, and possessions. He leads through love. So what do they give their time and attentions and resources to? Is it for themselves, for their own security? No, you give your time, your talents, your possessions, your energy to love. So what John is saying to them essentially is love creates security. Love creates security. Not power, not prestige, not possessions. Love creates security. Love creates security because it gives you a grounding in who you are as a person that cannot change no matter what your circumstances are. In fact, psychologists now know through multitudes of studies that only about 10 to 15% of your well-being is related to your circumstances. So the money you have, the position you have at work, how influential you are in your community, 10 to 15% of your ability to feel comfortable in the world. Reality is, what makes you feel comfortable in the world? That you feel loved. That you feel bound to a family or bound to a community of people that will watch out for you, a community of people that will challenge you and push you to grow, to thrive in life. And so this is why we see at the beginning of verse 15 and 16, John says to them, he starts off talking to them about how do they protect themselves from these false teachers. He says that you acknowledge that Jesus is God and God lives in them and they are in God. That they are like Jesus. They are grounded in the reality of Jesus. And that that is what they can rely on. They don't rely on their power and prestige and possessions. No, they rely on the love that God has for them because God himself is love. That the whole understanding we have of who God is wrapped up in Jesus. And that person is loving. Not wrathful, not angry, not ready to smite you off the face of the earth when you do wrong. God is love. And whoever lives in God lives in, whoever lives in love lives in God and God lives in them. And so John starts to weave this understanding of love right into their understanding them. And he says to them, you need to think about this because if you're evaluating whether somebody is truly speaking for Jesus, you have to look at the way they live. And you look at the way they live and you say, are they trying to scare us into acting? Are they trying to make us more afraid? Or are they grounding us in the life giving reality of love, the sacrificial nature of love? See, this is why I think John is challenging them on this, is that the reality is when we put our faith, our security in those kind of earthly things, power, prestige, and possessions, we are putting our faith in something that is temporary. We are putting our faith and our trust and our grounding of who we are in something that is fleeting. We spend money, right? It comes in, it goes out, like the tide, right? Even when we try to hold on to it, it kind of bleeds away in pieces. And we can't fully know God, we can't fully know ourselves when we're living in a reality that is so bound up in that fear-based life, a life that is grounded in things that will wash away. I think the big mistake many of us make is that we believe that God is out to get us and that he's ready to pour his anger out on us, when the reality is that God loves us and wants to draw us closer to himself because of his great love for us. And so then John keeps unpacking this. He says, okay, so if you love God and God is in you, what does that look like? How do we know? It's not just somebody saying, well, yeah, I love Jesus. He's great. He's awesome, right? How do we actually know if somebody's telling the truth about that? Well, it's easy. A love for God is marked by Christ-like behavior. A love for God is marked by Christ-like behavior. It isn't about where you show up on Sunday morning. It isn't about whether you put a fish on your car. It isn't about whether you say you believe the right things. What does it mean to be in God and be grounded in the love of God? You act like Jesus. And how did Jesus act? He loved people. He expressed compassion for the vulnerable. He went out of his way to give up what he had for the sake of other people. His actions changed people. And what's amazing is Jesus lived this incredibly impactful life while being completely rooted in the peaceful, contemplative, prayerful life of a disciple, that Jesus modeled for us, that the way that we get the energy and the motivation and the ability to give ourselves over to other people is to stop and slow down once in a while. Which is amazing, because if there's anything we need in our world more, it's to stop and slow down, right? I think the challenge that many of us have is that we wrestle with the fact that when Jesus said some of the things that he said, it kind of counters the way that we look at the world, right? Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, not blessed are the war makers, right? And we've been told through stories and songs and culture that the people that really affect our world for change and make the world a better place and are blessed and are enriched in their lives are the people that go out there and show their force. That Jesus counters so much of what we've learned to believe we think we know about the world. And so this is the thing. Think of it this way. A lot of the time, I think what we end up doing is like we do this thing where we say, I'm a follower of Jesus now. And it's like, think of it like your life is a house. Okay? I know it's a stretch, but just think of it. Think of your life as like a house. And a lot of the time what we do is we hang pictures of Jesus in our living room, and we maybe buy a bigger sofa so that when people want to come over, we can, you know, do house church or Bible study or whatever. We make the room a little more fancy. We maybe, you know, change the decorating. We kind of make it a little more contemporary, or we get new curtains and try and make it more warm and inviting. And we may even, you know, put worship music on all the time instead of listening to whatever it is we used to listen to. We do this thing where we kind of renovate the living room. We renovate the, you know, the floor. But the funny thing is, it's like what Jesus is saying is, when I love you, you don't just change the interior. You go outside. You go out into that beautiful garden that's stretched out behind you and explore. You realize that you have only been living in this little contained reality. You've only been living in this really constricted environment that is just safe and simple. And I don't want you to just make your safe and simple reality look like me. I want you to get out there. Go be with the people that need love. Go be with the people that need to have someone be on their side. Go and express the unending love of God to your neighborhood, to your families, to your communities, to the ends of the earth. I think we fear sometimes what we don't know. And so sometimes that fear keeps us rooted in this kind of Jesus-looking bubble that keeps us from actually doing the things that Jesus said, this is what it looks like when I love you. And that Jesus is actually with us wherever we go, right? We think, well, we've got to get him and keep him. But Jesus actually comes with us wherever we go. And so we don't need to be afraid, because our security is transportable. Our security is rooted in the deepest parts of who we are. And then later on in 1 John 4:18, John says this. There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. This is an amazing verse. And this is a verse that oftentimes gets kind of twisted, because we take this verse and we interpret it sometimes in some translation that says, you know, perfect love drives out all fear, or there is no fear in love. And it makes it sound like if you love God, the mark of being a lover of Jesus is that you're a fearless, crazy person that, like, you know, will do anything and will drop everything and will, you know. And it's actually, the word perfect there actually means total, as in there is no fear that God's love can't touch. There's no fear in your life that is too scary for God to deal with. There is no fear that you cling to and hold on to that God can't deal with. And for many of us, that fear is so buried within us because we're so afraid to bring it out, because we're afraid of being judged. I think we've brought up and learned the habits of avoiding dealing with fear because we're worried we'll be rejected for it from our families, from our friends, our coworkers, our parents, the other moms at school, the people you see after church. I think we fear that if we bring that to the surface, if we bring that insecurity to the surface, we won't fit in anymore. And I think those of you that have been told that kind of God hates you and Jesus kind of swoops you in and takes you out from that, this is the truth, that God is so loving that there is nothing that you are afraid of that he can't handle. And you need to embrace that reality in order to really manage the fear in your life. I think, unfortunately, a lot of men have been raised to see fear as a weakness. And we see fear as the ultimate betrayal of our strength. When the reality is, fear isn't really the problem. It's how we face it. And here's the thing. When John is talking about judgment to this Jewish group of Christians, he's not talking to them about judgment the way we think of it. Most of the time, we think of judgment as this, and I put this in the notes there. We tend to think of judgment as this, like I will call it moral judgment. We think, I'm being judged because I did a bad thing. I broke the law. I sped in traffic. I robbed a bank. There's some rule book, and I broke one of the rules. And I'm being judged for it, and I will be punished accordingly, right? Here's the problem. That's not actually the judgment that John is talking about. John is talking to them about relational judgment. He's saying the reason why perfect love casts out fear, it moves fear to the side, it moves it to its proper place in your life, is because when you are deeply rooted in the love of God, you are never alone. That you are free from the relational judgment of being lonely, which is maybe the most crippling thing that a human being can feel. In fact, that is probably the most frightening thing about the concept of hell that we see in the Bible, is because the way hell is described in the Bible is complete and total isolation, which really, if you think about it, is the most frightening thing another person can think about. And this is why John says there's no fear in love, because you can't be afraid when you're rooted to the deep relational reality of God. And so fear comes from a fear of judgment. I know I used fear twice in that sentence, but I had to ride roller coasters this week. Fear comes from a fear of judgment. Most of the time, our fears are deeply rooted in us feeling like we will be rejected. And the problem with that is that we end up feeling rejected because of our fears, right? We end up feeling like that this thing, if I vocalize it, if I say I'm afraid of this, that we will be pushed aside, when in reality, embracing the love of God means you can admit and be honest about what you fear without worrying about being rejected, because God is with you. God gives you the ability to handle that fear. So, now that we know where fear belongs in the story, where do we go from here? And this is the interesting thing, is that John actually carries this thought through the rest of his letter. He goes through and says, you need to be afraid not of God's judgment, but you need to be careful of people that will try and tell you you need to be afraid. Which is kind of insane, right? That seems a little like topsy-turvy to us. But this is the thing. The real thing that we need to watch out for in life is people trying to use fear to make us do things, to make us be the people that God doesn't want us to be, right? That's the thing, that what we really need to be careful of, what we really need to watch out for is fear manipulating us, and that you actually can live without fear. So then what does that actually do to your life? How do you actually express that in the world? Well, later on in the letter, John says this, and this is what God has testified. He has given us eternal life. And this is the life, and this life is in his Son. Whoever has the Son has life, and whoever does not have God's Son does not have life. See, the reality of fear in our lives is that we shouldn't just be hopeful that things will get better. I talk to a lot of people, and I feel like that's their attitude. Their attitude is they're just waiting desperately for things to get better. And you and I, we have a choice about what we are going to do with that conflicting feeling. We have a choice of what we're going to do with that. And what John says is, here is what God has testified. Here's what God has said. If you commit your life to following Jesus, if you root yourself in God's love, Not only do you not need to be afraid, your life will radically change to the point that your life actually doesn't look like any other life that you've experienced before this. It will be an eternal life. And so once we shed our fear of judgment, we get freed up to start working towards the things that we were really always meant to do in this world. And we don't have to deal with that constant nagging sense that we're just ready, right on the brink of being condemned to a miserable life because we made a mistake. And so therefore, what love ends up doing for us is it ends up opening up our lives to other people. The hallmark quality of somebody who follows Jesus and loves God is somebody who serves other people. If you and your relationship with God is all about you, then you've mixed up something along the way. So what I want to do is take that principle of life and a life free of fear and rooted in love and kind of apply it to our everyday lives. We tend to, I think, and we talked about this earlier, we tend to kind of say, well, the circumstances I have in my life or the thing that I don't like about the world is somebody else's fault. We like to blame other people. We like to say, this is because of the economy, or this is because, you know, nobody has moral fiber anymore, or this is because, kids today are too distracted with their technology, or whatever it is. We like to come up with reasons why the situation we find ourselves in isn't the situation we want it to be. But here's the problem with that. If no one steps up, nothing gets done, right? And if nothing ever gets done, nothing changes. So if you don't like something about the world that you see in and you want to see it changed, you've got one choice to make. Are you going to give in to the fact that things aren't the way you want them to be? Or are you going to step up? Now, if you call yourself a follower of Jesus, this means you're going to need to focus your energy on how not only to improve things, but also how do you spread love and joy to the most people around you. It doesn't have to be just your pet projects and personal missions. Remember, the way out of fear is to stop looking at your own needs. And I think a lot of the time we just adopt Jesus into our own pet project instead of saying, what can I do that will affect the most amount of people in the most loving and amazing ways? Remember, the way out of fear is to stop focusing on yourself and to start thinking about what you can do for other people. And so what ends up then becoming a question for us is then, what if the thing that I need to do, that I need to fix, that I want to see bettered in the world, what do I do to attack that? Oh, I missed this point apparently. Thanks, Jaden. A life free of fear is a life full of love. And this is really what we're talking about, that your life, when it is free of fear, you will know that you are becoming unafraid because your life will be continually filled with love for other people. That's really what we're talking about. And that's the thing, is like, what do you need to do in your life to start to shed the false reality that you've built up that has caused you to become afraid of the world around you and start to really start to feel comfortable in your real skin, in the real you, in the you that is meant to actually be effective in affecting the world? So I want you to think about this. I want you to think about how can you contribute. I read once that many people are afraid to contribute because they think, well, who am I to do this? Who am I to try this task? When the real question should be, who are you to think you can't do this? Why do you think you don't get to join in? Why do you think you get to sit on the sidelines? What is keeping you from stepping up and living the life that you want? How do you want to do that? And I think this is the thing, that we start to have to embrace attention then. That part of learning how to live without fear is starting to realize that you'll never really live without it. Part of living without fear is to start to realize that, yes, fear is there to keep you safe and alive, but you don't want that fear of keeping you alive to keep you from living. It can start to feel like sometimes a rope that gets tighter the harder you fight it. You know, fear, I think, is felt by us in a lot of different ways. I think one thing that makes somebody feel judged feels like a reassurance to other people. You know, did you ever have that experience where somebody says something kind of sarcastic to you and you come from a really sarcastic family and you're like, oh, this actually makes me feel kind of at home? But then if a stranger says something kind of mean and pointed, you think, well, who are they? Like, what's going on? This is the thing. We all have our own kind of unique spin on this. We have a side of it that I think is challenging for us. And I think when we're in that situation, it's important to remember that even though life is never free of fear, we don't have to be controlled by it. I love Viktor Frankl has this great concept that he says that really what ends up happening in life is that we have these habits we've built up in life, and we tend to feel a conflict between how we are, something happens and we become afraid of it, and then it fires off a reaction, right? And we get so obsessed with controlling the reaction that we don't actually fix the problem, because the real thing we have to fix is that space between those two things. And so when you're in that space, when something happens that normally would make you afraid, you have a choice to make about how you're going to react to it. That's the thing. We often think we don't have a choice. We kind of abdicate responsibility for our lives over to our instincts. And we say, you know, this is just not going to happen. And so we just kind of let it happen, right? Whenever I walk into the kitchen, I see the cookies. I want to eat the cookies. And it just happens. I don't know what happened. The cookies are gone, right? Like, what happened? I think people act like they blacked out or something. It's like, I walked into the kitchen, and there were cookies, and now there are no cookies. What happened? Right? And this is the thing. That space between the trigger and the reaction is a holy space. It's a space where we actually can decide how we're going to react. Now, I want to kind of make a disclaimer here. If you haven't spent much of the time in the church, and this whole Christian thing is either kind of a little new to you, or you're very skeptical and you're like, I'm just here because my mom made me come, and if I do this, then I get Swiss Chalet afterwards. That's great. Here's the thing. I hope you wrestle with this stuff anyways, because truthfully, I think this principle becomes so much more effective when you ground yourself in God's love and realize the kind of more cosmic realities that are attached to it. But I think there's a principle here that works anyways. And this is what it is. I think that when you're unafraid of the future, you have the ability to influence it. You have the ability, this isn't like science fiction time travel, you actually have the ability to alter the reality in front of you because you're willing to embrace the choice you have in that space. You have an ability to actually influence the way things will happen because you are willing to question your reactions, right? And so I think, here's the thing, when you hide from fear, when you hide and try to straddle that space by just giving into it, I think what ends up happening is you end up pushing down a reality that comes out anyways, right? You end up kind of, I think of it like a balloon. You know, when you know, I don't know, my kids love playing with balloons. You know, when you squish a balloon, the air doesn't like go out of the balloon, right? It goes over to the other side of the balloon. Like, it just keeps pushing. Like, when you have fear in your life and you squish it down, it just kind of comes out in other things, right? It ends up coming out in that argument. You know, you might be afraid of how your coworkers see you. Then you come home and your wife says something to you that's kind of like what your coworker said, and all of a sudden that fear comes out of you, right? It ends up coming out of you, and it has this ripple effect that ends up kind of reverberating through your life anyways. So what if you chose to face things not because you just have to, but because you're actually being kind of faithful and honest to the reality of your life? You're actually being honest about what's going on under the surface. That, I think, ends up really altering the way we view our relationships. It means, what if instead of constantly worrying that your spouse doesn't care about you, that you start to realize that the more you love them, the more you pour into them, the more you sacrifice, the more they start to see the kind of amazing things that happen with love, and they actually may start to grow in their appreciation of you. It's amazing how when you're afraid of trying to succeed in life, you actually end up failing because you are so consumed with worry and doubt that it makes it impossible for you to function. So I think what we're trying to wrestle with is, how do we then end up functioning with fear in our life, even when we feel controlled by it, right? How do we function? How do we react to that? Well, I think the real question is, it's not about how do you get fear out of your life, it's how do you live with fear in your life. And the reality is, that's what courage is. Courage is having the willingness to act even when something is terrifying, right? It's having the will to do the right thing even when it scares the living daylights out of you. It's living with that eternal reference point in mind. We were talking about the Olympics this week at the office, and we were talking about some of the crazy events that are out there. And we were jokingly saying, you know, it's really hard sometimes when people are doing these crazy acrobatic things to know the line between bravery and stupidity, right? You're like, what is the difference? And we decided that bravery is just doing something stupid for the right reasons, right? It's just doing something that seems crazy, insane, unsafe, unwise, because it's the right thing to do, because it's the loving thing to do, because it is the sacrificing things to do. It's the thing to do because it needs to be done. So I wanted to wrap up things today with a story about maybe one of the most frightening experiences of my whole life. So a couple of years ago, Jillian was about 13 weeks into her pregnancy with our second daughter, Ellie, and we were just crossing that line, really fun line, those of you who are parents, where you get to actually start telling people that you have a baby coming. And we were just kind of crossing that line and had started kind of spreading the word outside of our immediate families about what was going on. And I'll be honest, it was our second baby, and so we both felt way more relaxed this time around. We kind of felt like, you know, this, we've done this before. We know what's going on. Second kids, any second kids in the house here? People who are the second born in their family? Okay, second kids, I have to level with you. It's not that we don't love you as much. It's just that we lost all our brain cells with the first one, okay? They all fizzled and burned off. So it wasn't like I wasn't excited about my second kid. It just felt kind of more normal, and honestly, we were just so tired from watching our other kid that we didn't really think about things. And then we were out with our family one day for kind of a family outing, and kind of right near the end of the trip, Jillian knew right away that something wasn't right. And so within minutes of talking about it, we were making plans to find the closest hospital. We sent Katie back with my brother and sister, or my brother and family, and my sister-in-law, who's a labor and delivery nurse, came with us to the hospital. And I know there's a lot of nurses that go to our church. I know that for you, people come in and it's very routine. You go, okay, this is what's going on. You follow the book. We know that. But the other people on the other side of the table, it's something you don't ever forget, right? And I honestly, I feel like to this day, I can replay every moment in my brain of everything that happened that day. That waiting to find out if our daughter was okay was excruciating. And it was awful because I felt like as a dad and a husband, my job was to kind of push all of those feelings down so that I could be supportive for Jill. But it took us 10 hours from the time that we checked into the hospital until we were told, basically, the baby's okay, but you need to watch this problem for the rest of the time that she's pregnant, and there's nothing you can do. And it's amazing, like to this day, telling that story, my heart starts to race. And I remember thinking that I had never felt that much fear in my life. The fear that we might lose the baby and that there was nothing I could do about it. I'll tell you, I didn't relax for 7 months. And honestly, when my daughter Ellie was born, I cried when both my kids were born. But when I cried when Ellie was born, it was because all of a sudden I was like, thank goodness she's here. I can hold her now, right? I can do something to take care of her. You know, I prayed every night of those 7 months that God would protect and grow our baby, which was something that I did all the time with our oldest daughter. But I kind of, again, like I said, seconds, I kind of didn't think about it with Ellie. And even now, thinking about that, I feel guilty and sick for not caring more, right? And I think we're in this same battle in life. We're in this battle between life and in life, between hope and hopelessness, between fear and courage, and between life and death. And so what our goal needs to end up being then is that our goal needs to be to spread the message of life in a world that is battling death. That our goal as people needs to be able to say that in a world that is full of chaos and anxiety and fear and unknown and all the other things we associate with death, that there is life. So may you choose life this week. Choose how to embrace love when all you feel is hate, and compassion when all you see is suffering. May you live free of the burden of your fears and be motivated by its impulse rather than captured by it. And may we be a community of people drawn together by the risen Christ who faced death and fear and conquered it all. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you so much for the life that you give us, for the unbelievable love that we experience when we draw close to you. And I pray that for every person in this room this week, that they would feel a tangible sense of that love and compassion. If you can reach us through all of the mess, that we know we can be stable, we can be home, we can be free. And so I pray this week that you would motivate us to feel unafraid, to feel that even when we feel the fear, that we can act anyways because we have the security of knowing that nothing will separate us from your love. And I pray that if for some people in this room, if this is the first time they've ever embraced that idea, that you would just give them a baby step to figuring that out, a conversation, a moment in their week that they look at differently. And for those of us who've been on this journey for a long time, remind us of that truth. Remind us of that need for compassion for others and compassion for ourselves when we mess up. So I pray that you would help inspire us this week with that reality, God, and help us to live fearless lives where we live as if life is eternal because it is, and that we are just taking one step forward on an amazing, unending journey into the loving embrace that you have for us. And I pray that you would do that in dynamic and amazing and spirit-filled ways this week, God, in your name. Amen. Thanks so much for coming, guys. Stick around. We have these ice cream floats. Don't be afraid to take seconds. I give you permission. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.